Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I speak with Elizabeth Turner, founder of Precipitate, a specialty architecture firm that merges research, collaboration, and sustainable design to improve building performance. Elizabeth's work bridges academia and practice, tackling complex challenges around passive house design, community engagement, and climate action, all while defining her own version of solo practice. Her consulting-based practice is like the honey guide, a small African bird known for its remarkable partnership with humans. The honey guide can locate wild beehives, but it needs a person to open them. In return, both share in the sweetness of the honey. It's a meaningful collaborative relationship built on trust, curiosity, and a shared reward. Like the honey guide, Elizabeth has built her career guiding others, students, research teams, and adjacent professionals towards discoveries they could not reach alone. In this episode, we discuss how crossing these boundaries builds a community vision and lays the groundwork for architectural projects. Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and today I am meeting with Elizabeth Turner, who is the founder of Precipitate, an architecture firm here in Minnesota that focuses on passive house consulting and energy modeling and all the good things that can be added to projects and refine projects to make them perform even better in the long term for their clients. So welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what brought you to start Precipitate and how long you've been going with this?
Yeah, so I started Precipitate in 2017 in the summer, and I was kind of noticed, like I had done a lot of sustainability training and research assistantship positions while I was in grad school, and it was just such a challenge to actually get to implement them on real projects in the firms where I was working. And I had been teaching at the University of Minnesota Sustainability Studies capstone course. And one of the readings that I inherited was Danella Meadows' works on systems change. And so as I was having conversations in firms about like why there was difficulty kind of shifting to more energy efficiency work, and also at the same time reading this work of like how do you make change happen in this system, it really became clear to me that the way to make it happen was what's called a paradigm shift. So we kind of focus a lot on making change happen on these like metrics and the things that aren't super impactful, and they put a lot of energy there. But the real thing is that I needed to have a firm that the purpose was high levels of energy efficiency to really be able to make that happen, and not the purposes, like the very good and important purposes that traditional firms are founded on, would always be a fight. And once I kind of broke free from that system, it was really exciting to see a lot of possibilities open up, and kind of I was able to design the firm to focus on high performance of research and kind of come back and support firms in that work. So that's been really exciting to see happen.
You know, Elizabeth, you're one of the first in our like generation at the U of M to have started your own firm. So I always looked up to you and how you were right there jumping into it. It was really impressive and still is. It's interesting that in the firms I've jumped around in, it's like there's a culture that's driven by how are decisions made? And sometimes it's profit, sometimes it's projects. And you alluded to this, that other firms are kind of founded on those basic values and the people that they're serving or the people in the firm. But you're in this mission-driven, purpose-filled scope of work where you're trying to create that paradigm shift. So it makes so much sense that you had to start from the ground up and build this around that new idea, start from scratch, and let the profit, let the people, let the projects fit in around this missional base and help that drive the decision. So that makes a lot of sense. I loved how you mentioned the Danella Meadows project. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, she's just she's a systems thinker. So she has a book called Thinking in Systems. And there's a particular chapter in that book called Levers in Systems. I'm not getting that perfectly correctly, but it just really helps outline like how we can make change happen within systems. So it works for, you know, firm culture, but also we actually used it as a foundational text when we were working on the Culture Change Initiative with AIA Minnesota and thinking about how we can shift the culture of architecture firms in the state to be more inclusive. So there's a lot of purposes and it works for our personal life. So I highly recommend for people thinking about systems and wanting to make change that text.
I think it's really fascinating that your journey started in the educational realm and applying this research and working at the University of Minnesota, teaching students this, but within the academic sphere, it can feel shielded from actual change in the community and in actual projects. And so What was it like to breach that gap? And have you gone back to teaching in any capacity and how your firm reaches out?
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the courses that I've been engaged with and taught or helped support and develop have all been applied research-based courses at the University of Minnesota and at St. Olaf, kind of doing real projects with community members and applying sustainability concepts to them. So even the research I was doing was looking at how do you design a net zero campus and working with campus planning and project management, kind of real projects. So that's hard to answer because I feel like it's my experience. Like you're totally right. And the experience that I have had has been really focused on kind of what's the practical application of this academic work. Yeah.
I love that clarity because there's an assumption that the studio exists in a bubble.
Yeah.
And there are these programs, there are ways to be adjunct and professors and lead studios that actually talk to real people.
Yeah.
And when I've taught, I've also appreciated doing that and introducing students to real people who have real needs that are different than an academic brief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm currently, for the past few years, I've been teaching the Net Positive Design Studio. It's the second year. It's in the second year of the graduate program. And the goal is to design a net positive building. So it, you know, would produce more energy than it consumes. But I've used kind of housing projects recently where we brought in real clients who are trying to, you know, figure out these, you know, big questions, like how do we do energy efficient, resilient housing and what could that look like? Which I think is just a really great opportunity for students to talk to developers and see what the constraints are. Because I always approach constraints as like something that makes your projects better, not preventing us from doing this, you know, beautiful design that we can dream up in the studio.
You're ready to meet the challenge. I love that.
Yeah.
And so are the clients that you talk with and meet with your students, are they the same type of clients and projects that you do with Precipitate?
That is such a good question. I feel like I've met them adjacent to my work with Precipitate. And, you know, a lot of the current clients that I have are people that I've known for a decade. I knew that I didn't really want a marketing budget. I just wanted to dedicate time to advocacy because I couldn't not do that. Like I just had to do that. That's the time that we're in. We need to have climate action happening. So I did a ton of volunteering work and I taught and applied for grants to do research. So through that work, I've met a lot of people and I'd say some of them are clients and some of them I can pull in to do studio projects or other kinds of projects. So it kind of comes from the same source, but I haven't had a studio project that has become a client or vice versa.
Okay. So those are kind of separate realms that you kind of operate in, separate worlds, but same content that you're able to develop and refine and move forward with.
Yeah.
For those architects who maybe have never written a grant or don't understand how grant writing can be part of professional practice, can you explain some of that? How do you meet people that can be potential collaborators by just writing a grant or receiving a grant?
Yeah, so definitely volunteering is a great way to meet people initially. Figuring out what are the things that you're passionate about, like what keeps you up at night and is a question that you really want to figure out the answer to that you think would be really impactful and make an impact or a change in the profession, because that's probably going to be something that somebody else wants to fund. So that's the first piece. The practical side is there. Often if there's grants available, they'll have a informational meeting or some kind of like webinar that you can go to. And then you can meet other people who are there, like take note of who else is in the room and reach out to them. Because I think the most important thing is like, it's very hard to get a grant if you've never applied for a grant before. And it's just you. So it's really important to collaborate with people who bring something else to the table, who are super smart and in ways that are different from your strengths. Those are the kinds of projects that I really see getting funded. And also, I'd say like having a kind of like I can kind of bring the academic and research side of that to the table and partner with people who are really engaged in the community where we're going to do the project or do the research is really important. So, you know, that's my assessment of like where my strengths are. I also am not connected to a big research institution. So I partner a lot with large research institutions or the University of Minnesota to do the research because I need to tap into that wealth of knowledge and information that is accessible through that.
And technically, some of those organizations are that 501c3 status.
Yes.
That is sometimes required with certain grants. And so you're creating this partnership based on passion and you're aligning yourself with someone else to help them and reach those distinct goals. I love that. And who else is in the room when you've gone to these things? Are there other architects there, or is it, you've mentioned community members, you mentioned academics, but who else is like in this world that you're going to get to meet? Is it for housing or is it for sustainability?
That is such a good question. I think it's a lot of, I'd say there's a lot of community organizations that are interested in making things happen and like nonprofit research organizations.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's so interesting that all of these things exist. We don't talk about the groups that are out there doing other things when we're in architecture school. We're just kind of focused on just equipping ourselves to enter the professional world.
Right.
And it's hard to understand the network that we're entering and that already exists. And it sounds like you found that because you followed your passion and you broke into those networks and you introduced yourself and you weren't afraid to volunteer and just be there and be present and put yourself into it. And that really opened doors and made things possible for Precipitate.
Yeah, I think it's kind of about risk. I feel like architecture as a profession is necessarily risk averse. Like there's a lot of lawsuits that happen when we do things that are innovative. There is, you know, a potential to lose revenue and then have to let people go because you can't afford to pay them. Like these things are really true and challenges in architecture. And so I'd say like the biggest thing about being on my own, but for anybody who is thinking about having a practice, like you're just able to take on risk in a different way that is necessary for change, but is so hard and challenging. and I think, you know, being in business for 8 years now, like I feel like I'm starting to become a little more risk averse and like the things that I was willing to risk in the beginning, I'm not really willing to do anymore. So like, I think I'm evolving too, to be less of a startup and more of a traditional firm as I go along. But I've, you know, taken the risk to kind of figure out what I want it to be and what it needs to be. Cause even just going to a meeting, you know, about a potential grant, that's not a billable hour. Filling out a grant application is not a billable hour, and you don't know if you're going to get it. So even just, you know, writing a proposal for a project that's not typical is a risk in itself too.
So true. And when you've chosen a topic that's on this cutting edge, it's got to be driven by passion. It's got to be driven by these deeper values, mm-hmm. because the case study for the financial argument isn't necessarily there yet. You're creating the first of its type. You're creating this cutting edge idea of this is how the models work. This is how the ideas are going to play out. And you're projecting that and explaining that to your client. And okay, you're putting in more money now during construction. And this is what the projected payout will be in how much energy savings you have. And if that's a value they have, then they will be looking for that buy-in and that assurance during the initial design discussions. And that's what your team kind of brings to the table.
Yeah.
So the name Precipitate, mm-hmm. where did that come from? And maybe what three words describe your firm?
Yeah. So I have always loved chemistry. It was my favorite class in high school. And I love this idea that you can put two liquids together that are clear, colorless, and out of that chemical reaction, like when you combine them, you can precipitate out a solid like thing. And I think that's really true for like, that's kind of what architects do and what I wanted to do, right? Is like collaborate. So I think collaboration is one of like the most important word for the firm, because the whole goal is that I can come alongside other teams who are wanting to do high performance work and either do the energy modeling for them, do some research, or bring some building science expertise to the table. I can't do that alone. And so like that combination is really important. And also just thinking like in architecture, we can't do our work without clients that are part of, you know, bringing the vision and the finances and the goals and drivers. And then the other meaning of the word is to kind of rush boldly ahead and precipitate change happening in the profession. So that's kind of the goal. And then it also means to steeply decline. And that's also the goal. I want to see a steep decline in carbon emissions from the building sector as quickly as possible. So that often means like doing things that are not the norm, like sharing knowledge and doing education and being really open with the behind the scenes, like secrets of the business, because the goal isn't like, I want to make a good living, but I really want to make change happen in our profession, even beyond that. So I'd say the other goals, the other words that go along with that are performance. So thinking about how our buildings performing is really important, and then research. So actually coming back and measuring how the buildings are performing for people, like how are they feeling in spaces? What's the air quality? What's the actual utility consumption? Finally, at this point, 8 years in, we have enough buildings that are up that we're doing some research on those actual buildings, but it's taken a long time to get there. So the initial research was more hypothetical and looking at energy models and modeling performance. And now we can actually do the research of the actual projects, which is very exciting.
That is exciting, but that almost implies a phasing of your firm. There's your starting projects, then you're assessing projects. What's that next phase?
Yeah, I think what's really exciting is when I first started, like I did one passive house project the first year, and then a couple of years later, I did another. And I did a lot of planning of like, okay, what types of projects should I be doing to, you know, precipitate change happening, doing projects that are more carbon friendly, and did a lot of different types of projects like pure architecture, consulting, research, to try to figure that out. And I think what now that there's a large demand for passive house consulting, that's kind of what I'm doing and focusing on, which I really enjoy. It's the nerdy spreadsheets and energy models and like all this stuff. Like I think about myself as kind of an interpreter between engineering teams and the architect and the contractor, really kind of, you know, figuring out the most cost-effective path to do energy efficiency. And now there's enough of that work that it can be the primary thing that I do, with a few kind of fun design projects on the side to keep my architect designy brain engaged and kind of implement some of the next round of innovation as well. So yeah, finally like finding that stride and sometimes it takes 8 years.
This is a lifelong career that I think we continue to adapt and change and hopefully precipitate as we move forward.
And I think that's the goal. Like in the future, our energy code will just be super efficient. So I've done a lot of advocacy with AIA Minnesota Government Affairs. And in Minnesota, we're very fortunate that our energy code will be much stronger by 2036. And, you know, then like, what's next? Then can I just focus on beauty? That would be amazing. You know, like we're just doing energy efficiency. So then I can look to the next thing and always be looking towards what's next.
Yeah, it's interesting how our standard of care is shifting. And it did that a lot in 1990 when the ADA Act went through. Mm-hmm. And now we're doing it in a different way in how we're designing the materials and the performance of our buildings. So that's huge change and a learning curve for a lot of us who haven't been.
Yes.
There were sustainability classes when I went through. And so I got a little dabble of it. And I've seen some of those spreadsheets and they are kind of fun. It is kind of fun to see how like chemistry is not my thing, but math is my thing. And so the mathematics of like percentage of window openings and how that plays out in some of the passive performance of the building, which is exciting to set up a structure for success where it's placed. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, is there more about how you've designed your firm to reflect your personal strengths, hopes, and dreams? Mm. What kind of started you off on this path?
Yeah. Just a deep desire. Like I'd say climate anxiety is really what started me off. Just knowing that there was a lot more we could do. Seeing that in other areas of the country and world, people were doing more for climate responsive architecture and thinking about carbon and just feeling like I have to try something. Like, you know, it might be a grand failure, but I have to at least try. So that was part of it. I think the other was just not seeing a lot of opportunities for continued growth and mentorship in a traditional firm structure. And so what I really love now is I can hire people to be team members for, you know, one project and come in and do details or help me with the spec. And really that's a mentorship opportunity. And I can choose who I am bringing on to mentor me. And like, hopefully we're mentoring each other a little bit. But that's really exciting. Like those relationships, building those and learning from each other, I would say is another really important part of the firm culture.
That's great. And it seems to have been a foundation that's really brought you through your career thus far. Mm-hmm. If you're ready for it, I do have a bird for you.
Yeah, great.
I was kind of Googling this before we started and everything I've heard up till now is just reassuring me that this is just the perfect alignment with how you practice. I had not heard of this bird before, but it is a honey guide. Mm. And a honey guide is an African bird. And it's actually kind of got a rich culture in African tradition. It does what its name says. It guides people to find honey because the honey guide bird cannot open up a honey comb itself. It needs the help of a honey badger or a human to break it open. Huh. And so there's actually this long tradition in certain African cultures of the symbiosis between the honey guide bird calling the human when it's ready for a human to come and find a nest, a beehive, or the humans having calls to bring the honey guide bird to go with them to go find the hive. And the humans can't find the hives alone, but the honey guide can and can sense where those bees are and guides it along. And I think that just aligns so well with what you're doing with how you're pairing with other firms. You're not meant to do this alone. Mm-hmm. You're built for that collaboration. You're built as that, mm-hmm. you call it a chemical solution that you're combining with others and you're integrating into their teams. Mm-hmm. And so not a weakness, but it does require collaboration to have those results. And it's also pairing with how you're guiding your students and leading them down this new path that hasn't been explored yet. and how you're working with projects and clients and communities who are on the edge of this sort of sustainability and climate action projects and practice. So
that's beautiful. Thank you. I love it.
So yeah.
Yeah. I feel like there's like this myth that I'd love to dispel. I feel like people who are miserable in traditional practice are like, I have to stay because like people literally told me, well, I'm sorry that you just couldn't take it anymore. And you're never going to work on big, important projects anymore because you're just by yourself. And that's not true at all. It's not. I think it's like a myth that like keeps us stuck in places we're not happy and says a lot more about the person who is saying that than the person who is going out on their own and trying something new. So I just love to like tell the listeners that you can collaborate, you can work on big, exciting things, even if you're not in the traditional structure of a traditional firm. And there's a lot of opportunity. And I've been able to collaborate more being on my own than I have before that point. So it's very exciting.
I have also found, I loved working with the people that I got to work with in firms. They were great places to work. Mm-hmm. But it has been reassuring not to lose fun projects as my own. And so I will echo that experience. Like, yeah, sometimes you do things that you just got to do. And, but that's the, that's sometimes how practice goes. But you keep hungry for these other dream projects, these changes you want to happen, the people that you want to see impacted by your practice. And you kind of follow that hunger. Mm-hmm. To seek them out and to serve them where they're at.
Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not a clock in, clock out sort of thing, but sometimes there's an itch that we want to scratch that we just need to serve the world with our skills. And I hear that from how you're how you're talking about how you're mission driven and structuring your practice to kind of satisfy that need to go beyond just clock in, clock out. That you can do that with being more flexible by being on your own.
And even just like being so focused on billable hours and working for somebody else, like I felt a real sense of responsibility to like not get, you know, not have like get to know you conversations or like just be very, very focused with my time. And it's nice to have some flexibility and freedom with that. Like I see it more as, oh, shoot, this isn't a billable hour, but I'm investing in relationships. So I see it not as like a waste of time, but an investment. And I think that shift is really exciting too.
So let's talk a little bit more about that investment time, because you mentioned not just having a marketing budget. And I felt the same way.
Yeah.
I felt like I didn't want to just spend money on ads or spend money on SOPs or search engine optimization or just radio things. I don't know, or print things. I wanted to take that money that would typically be used for marketing and build something, provide value, create content or something more. And it was a way to shift and give back before I asked to be a part of a project. And so has that kind of been a similar attitude in your firm? And what maybe some of the logistics, do you give yourself a percentage of time? Or permission to do that? Or are there seasons of doing this kind of give back sort of approach?
I had a really great mentor when I first started the firm. And he told me, he's like, Elizabeth, what does it mean to have an architecture firm? Like, what do you need to be able to do architecture work? And, you know, I listed a bunch of stuff. And he's like, no, like all you need to do is have clients. And, it doesn't matter if you're paid or not necessarily at first, like you, but you need to be doing something and building your portfolio. So he said, he kind of like did some research of other sole practitioners. And he said, you know, a lot of sole practitioners first starting out have like a 50-50 blend. So do 50% billable work, 50%, you know, working on building current or future clients and like investing in relationships. So I, put together a list of people who I really admired and respected. I had like this note card and I just took a bunch of people out to lunch and talked to them for an hour. not like none of this was really like meant to build clients relationships. And I'd say most of it didn't. But it really helped me understand what the need was. So just relationship building, I think, is one of the things that is really important. The other piece is like doing research and making myself better. So reading, going to as many conferences as I could afford was really important. Kind of staying on the cutting edge of technology. And so for me, that was passive house consulting. For others, you know, there might be something else that you can become an expert in. And then doing advocacy work. So I was the co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee with AIA Minnesota for a couple of years. That was a lot of time. That was unpaid. I was a part of the culture change leadership team, I think is what we called ourselves in the end, where we, you know, met very often. We hosted focus groups with, I think, over 80 people in the Minnesota architecture community about changing culture and what that could look like. So that was probably the biggest advocacy work that I did in terms of amount of time. Oh, and teaching, like you don't get paid very much teaching, but for me, it's really important to help me keep thinking creatively, surrounding myself with smart and passionate students and fellow faculty members. I always like, it's so much time and effort to teach, but it's always in the end worth it because I feel like I really get a lot out of it.
Yeah, one side mission of my firm is to serve small towns across Minnesota, greater Minnesota. And so that very similar, I've tried to complement that with volunteering with AIA through Minnesota Design Team and trying to engage with communities that way. And that led me to take my students at Dunwoody to those communities after the fact and to do their projects in those communities. And then on another side, it's like, this is kind of weird, but before I started my firm, I just went to small towns and talked to people.
Cool.
And like looked at what the small town was. And it's like, gosh, there's so much potential here. And just talk to business owners and be like, so what is the pressure point? Why are there down in Redwood Falls, there's a beautiful downtown. It's like 2 by 5 blocks or more than that. And only 5 businesses were open before Christmas. It's like a coffee shop, a jeweler, a little niche place, an insurance company, but every other storefront was full of storage. And I haven't been back to check, but it's just, it was a pressure point. Like I want to see these small towns thriving and I want to encourage people to be living in small towns because I feel like that's a place that communities can thrive and grow. And I just love the culture of small towns, similar to how you're wanting to improve the culture of how people interact with energy or use energy and respond to the climate. And I see a lot of parallels in how this has worked, but I have been very surprised that, I don't know, it's been like 80 or 90% of my projects come from other architects. And so this relationship of, yes, I want to reach out and meet people and communities, but the reality is most of my projects have actually come from actually just professional networking.
Yeah.
And so that can't be understated that I would just volunteer with Search for Shelter.
Yeah.
I would volunteer with Minnesota Design Team or AIA and just be involved and engaged and present with other professionals. And when projects didn't like fit their firm or fit their timeline, there was a lot of give. And I think that's really incredible about this community that I've gotten to know here in this state. It's been very supportive. And I don't know if you could give that same like percentage of projects that come from other architects because you're also serving other architects.
Yeah. I don't know what the percentage is. I'd have to think about that a little bit, but I'd say, you know, because my focus is so much on energy efficiency work, I probably pass on more projects to other architects than I even, like, I'd say I get a lot of projects from being on a team with other architects, but end up passing on a lot of projects because, like, you can kind of, if somebody's reaching out to you, like, that's because there's a relationship there and you just want, there's a desire to have the project done well and find somebody who's going to be a really great fit and be really passionate about it. So I'd say that's been really fun is to kind of like do some matchmaking. And
And that is so true. Yeah.
Also just realizing that like you don't need to do every project, right? Like I think there's a scarcity mindset that we can kind of get trapped in that like, oh my gosh, I need to take every project and I just need to grow and take on all the work. And like, you don't have to. You can see other people thrive in their own firms. And that is also very exciting. Like we're a whole profession. We don't want one firm to thrive. And I think when you get a specialty like Passive House Consulting, it can be very tempting to say like, I don't want anybody else to do it. This is my niche. Like this is my territory or whatever. And that just comes from a scarcity mindset. Like what I really want is for every single project in the state to be doing a Passive House project. So how am I working to make that happen? And how am I passing on projects to other people or doing education that's free and, you know, speaking at, I would say a huge thing is to speak at the AIA Minnesota convention. That is a great way to meet people and to have people come up to you after and want to learn more. And it can seem like, why am I giving away the secrets of my project? But no, like we're just making the whole entire profession better, which improves the value of architects and makes people want to hire us and increase our value in the community. So yeah, we might be flying solo, but we're really part of the larger flock of architects across the state. And when we support each other, I think we all benefit.
And you're catching a nuance with the name of this podcast is that we're not actually alone. It's just that we have the ability to fly where we want to fly. Mm-hmm. And if we see our own vision, we allow ourselves to follow that vision instead of just following the flock because it's the easier path.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
We're not just in a V of geese. We're willing to explore a little bit and take it on a little bit and to try different things. And we come back. I don't think I've interviewed anyone who's really alone in what they're doing because architecture is a service. Mm-hmm. Whether we're serving other architects or clients or the community, whatever we're doing, we're building value. And you're right. It's fighting that scarcity mindset so that we can continue to build. And you mentioned this at the beginning, from nothing. This clear solution, there's nothing. It looks like there's nothing there, but we are there at that moment trying to imagine what's possible and bring it about.
And I think it's like also like what I need in this moment too. So I really needed to be in a firm in my early career. I might go back because I'm ready, or you know, like that's what I need at the moment. I've talked to other solo practitioners who have done that too. So I think being really in tune with what you need for your career and your life outside of architecture, because honestly, that's a big part of it. With two little kids, it is very nice to not have to, you know, to be flexible and be able to work after bedtime and, you know, pick them up a little earlier from daycare. So like just very practical things like that to make it a good fit for where I am right now in my life.
So true. I don't have to explain to anyone why I maybe need a nap right now at like mid-afternoon or hide in a library like I did with my first two kids. And I'm like pregnant at a firm. I'm like, oh, I got to just disappear for a little bit. I just can't go on. And now I can do it from the comfort of my home. Or
yeah,
it is interesting. It's not easy to be deciding on that structure for yourself, because sometimes the decisions you make for yourself, you're like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best. And then you try it different next time.
Yeah.
So that you're building a better structure and a better balance and better boundaries.
Definitely, yeah. Always an experiment. I think of like, I really think of like, this was like a big hypothesis, like maybe this will work. And it's always testing that, like every month and kind of check in with that question, like what is working, what's not. And right now it is. So
are you good at that check-in? What kind of things do you ask yourself at that check-in?
I think it varies. Like, am I making enough money to support my family is a big, important one. That's very practical. But then on the other side, it's like, am I happy? Is the work that I'm doing meaningful? am I doing the work that I'm best at? I think that asking that question, like, what are you best at? Because you can do anything, but I think you'll have more value to your clients and you'll be happier if you're doing the things that you're best at. And for me, that's energy modeling. So that's been more and more of a yes. I've been able to hire people to help me with like doing some drafting and spec writing, you know, which is also from a professional liability perspective, really important, like not like only doing the things that you're best at. And then like, am I making an impact or are there things that I could be doing differently to make more of an impact?
I love that. And there's one more aspect of your business that I want to ask you about. It's that you've committed to being a specialist. It's all over your website, Passive House Institute US consultant, certified consultant. Mm-hmm. And that's everywhere and emphasized. So what are the challenges of being a specialist firm where you're trying to fill this niche?
Yeah, I thought that it would be a huge challenge and it actually hasn't. I feel like it's only been positive, which is like opposite of what I thought was going to be happen, what I thought was going to happen. So I don't know. I can't answer that question really because that is what I expected.
What did you fear would happen? What were the fears that maybe like, ooh.
You know, like I think unfortunately climate change has been really politicized. So I didn't want to put off people who might not understand climate science or feel like it's not a priority because they, you know, like I still would like to support people through architecture, even if they share different political beliefs. So that's one of them. That's maybe the only one, you know, just like alienating people, by being so bold in my vision of like what I thought the future of architecture could be and could look like, and like really focusing on equity as well, I felt was really important, but it can also be alienating. And what I found is it's just like, it just makes the right people who are good fits for the work I do easier to find, right? So there's less like, I'm not fielding a lot of requests from projects that aren't really a good fit. The people who are find my website or find me or who I know who are coming to me are like, yeah, I want to work with you. And like, I'm not asking for proposals from a bunch of people. I did so many proposals, Katie. I responded to so many RFPs the first few years. And it just was like, I was never going to get projects through that process. Because even that like very formal RFP process is like not the clients that I need to be working with. So yeah, it helps you find your people.
Yeah. I learned that lesson while at another firm. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't under my dollar, which was helpful. I did win us some RFPs with the ones that I wrote, but it was just the ones we worked so hard for and felt like we were such a good fit for. When you lose those, it's just like, oh,
yeah.
Like you loved all of these things, but just the fee was off.
Yeah.
Or, mm-hmm. And it's like, how do we, or this is the harder one, especially in historic preservation. Usually someone else had done a pre-design.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, man, they're just going to choose the firm right. that did their pre-design study that came with this RFP. How do I do that pre-design? How do I talk with them earlier? And that's a huge challenge. So I appreciate you sharing that. And it's so ubiquitous in our practice, but there are these other ways that you can be finding and serving clients and communities who aren't trained in that process. You're clearly doing lots of work through the University of Minnesota and St. Olaf. And there's other avenues to connect with people and be there. And it's hard to be there so early in the process because people are probably just Googling things and maybe they're even too intimidated to reach out to a professional like yourself at those points. But by being in those circles and being in those communities, you're almost like you're giving and you're offering yourself as this resource. And I feel like that makes it more approachable.
Yeah.
There is a book that someone recommended me that I'm reading right now that's called Jab Until It Hurts. Ooh. And it sounds weird. It's only a few hours. There's a different book I haven't read called Jab, Jab, Right Hook, where you give, give until you ask for your take. But this book called Jab Until It Hurts is about giving, giving, giving. And it's just this different mindset of like not thinking about the financial investment, but it's trusting the process, the opposite of scarcity, the growth mindset. It's trusting the growth mindset in business that if you give, people will understand that you're giving value and they'll see that value and they'll come to get more. And that's where that transition into an actual client relationship happens. Mm-hmm. But it's not being afraid to be generous and to be giving with your time. And it sounds like that's a lot of how you're approaching a lot of your practice.
Yeah. I think that it's hard though. Like I was just talking with my therapist about this yesterday. I was like, being generous is such a value that I have tied to my faith, and that's who I want to be in the world. And it's very hard to be generous and then be taken advantage of. And then you're like, okay, now, like when you get hurt, you're like, well, now what do I do? So that is a thing I have not figured out yet. But I think doing those check-ins is what helps too. Like you can be generous. And then I think, you know, like choosing who to be generous with. So like there's some big examples. Like I would not, you know, go to a Fortune 500 company and offer free sustainability advice, right? You have to find people who are aligned and, you know, like build some trust there too. So, yeah, I don't know. If you figure out the trick to that, let me know. But I think like you can't let the times that you get hurt affect you too. Like for sure, I have built relationships and then they choose somebody else to do the project. And you just like, you can't let that stop you from being generous and being the person you want to be.
It reminds me of that bird call of the honey guide.
Yeah.
That if you're advocating, you're putting it out there who you are. Mm-hmm. And so if someone responds, there's nothing you're hiding.
Right.
There's already that symbiotic vision of what you're looking, what you're offering and what they're looking for. There's something to being so bold that kind of takes away. You're being authentic about it because you do really care about this, but it does deter the tire kickers, deter people who are looking for something else or looking for a quiet, compliant architect to just fill out the paperwork.
Yeah. What I love to say is like, you know, like I'm probably not the best fit for your project. I feel like that's a really good phrase to learn and say when you need to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And being so clear about what you're going for, it also helps you be strong and assertive in a point and definitive in how you're responding to clients. So I do appreciate that. As for the giving, yeah, if you're not finding another source to fill you, you can't be looking for when you give.
Yeah.
If you assume that it's going to give back, that's not the point of this sort of mentality. And I don't think it's a perfect fit for everyone,
exactly.
But that's why there's all these different birds that I talk about with different architects. But as a honey guide, it seems like that give, that guiding to others, and you're not getting your feed until they break the hive. If they don't continue through and break it open, you're not getting anything out of that. And so it is a risk, but the niche you found and the community you found has been really rich and encouraging here, at least in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be the same in every geography or every state or every government system, but it seems to work really well here. And so it's been exciting to see how that's helped you refine your practice and continue to grow as an architect in the last 8 years as your own practice. So, yeah.
And you get to be who you want to be in the world too, which is like, that's half of the gift of being generous too. That's what I want my spirit to feel like. So
I love that. Well, thank you, Elizabeth. And this has been a terrific conversation. Is there anything else you want to leave with our listeners before we log off?
I'd say don't be afraid. I think fear is a thing that holds us back from living the kind of authentic lives that we want to. I have messed up so many times in the past 8 years of trying to run a firm, and it's been really hard, and it has, I would not change a thing. Like, it has brought me to where I am. It helped me learn. So live in kind of that hope and authenticity to yourself. And I just encourage you to, you know, put the fear aside.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Katie.
Elizabeth Turner built precipitate with a chemical definition that to precipitate means creating something from the combination of parts. In her practice, she combines unlikely collaborators, students and neighborhoods, government grants and underserved communities in order to bring about sweet changes in building standards. It's a future filled with energy savings, healthier materials, and resilient infrastructure for generations to come. Many of the professionals I interview emphasize the importance of collaboration. And that may seem ironic for a podcast called Flying Solo, but working together doesn't devalue soul practitioners. Our value as professionals is in making connections. And that leads us to our first takeaway, that collaboration is not a compromise. Looking at the Honey Guide, it doesn't survive alone. It thrives through connection, calling out to others, forming relationships based on trust, and leading others towards a shared goal. For those working solo, that's a reminder that independence doesn't mean isolation. The most successful one-person firms often operate as connectors, partners who bring clarity, depth, and focus to a team. Just as the Honey Guide finds the hive, your insight as a specialist can lead others towards something valuable, and together you can unlock opportunities that neither could achieve alone. And that helps us overcome our fears, which leads to our second point, having courage. For the Honey Guide, humans are superior, stronger, and potentially threatening. The beehive is also an overwhelming obstacle. So overcoming the fear of humans enables the Honey Guide to leverage a greater strength and overcome its obstacles, something it couldn't handle on its own. Elizabeth shared some of the fears and mistakes she has had to overcome. Each misstep was part of the process, a natural part of navigating new territory. She approaches new barriers in her process with curiosity, to overcome the fear, to dive in past the fear, admitting she may not know how to control all the variables, but she trusts that following her instincts will lead to a sweet solution. In the end, that's worth a bee sting or two. It also leads to future opportunities by building relationships and a stronger community, which is our final takeaway, building community. Perhaps the most beautiful thing about the Honey Guide is its relationship with humans, a quiet, reciprocal trust built over generations. Elizabeth's work echoes that same generosity in the way she mentors students, empowers communities, and shares her knowledge through teaching and consulting. Her impact extends beyond her own firm. She's working to create ripples in the profession, to inspire others to raise the quality of building performance. And for anyone trying to make a small difference in this big world, it may take the form of a purpose-driven practice. And when you have a deeper purpose, your success isn't measured in the quantity of projects or number of design awards, although those are nice affirmations along the way. Success for a purpose-driven leader is felt in guiding others towards a meaningful goal. And generosity, sharing what you know, and working together become a healthy ecosystem for growing that kind of change. So, if you are looking to build a hybrid practice that connects research and real-world design, start by collaborating with courage, leading with curiosity, and sharing the sweet success with your community. Season 2 of the Flying Solo podcast is sponsored by the Minnesota Architectural Foundation, whose mission is to invest in excellence, leadership, discovery, and equity within the profession of architecture. To join the Flying Solo movement, visit the website flyingsolo.live, that's flyingsolo.live, for links to our Instagram, Substack, and the Wingbeat newsletter, a weekly dose of birdspiration and practical tips to help you grow your business and your confidence as a solopreneur architect. While you're there, take the bird quiz to discover which bird best matches your solopreneur style. For even more resources and encouragement, you can find all the Flying Solo episodes on the Gable Media platform at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. the premier destination for podcasts about architecture and design. And if you're looking for community, connection, and real conversations, check out the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. There's a link in the show notes. Whether you join one of their masterclasses or the free Facebook group, you'll find a community of small firm architects sharing ideas, challenges, and wins, proving that while we may work solo, we're never alone. As Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, says, it's all about doing better practice and better work every day. Thank you for listening to Flying Solo. I'm Katie Kangas, and my hope is to empower you, aspiring architects and creative entrepreneurs, to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.